Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anwa Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anwa Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther. And today we've got a great guest and a great topic. Of course, I'm talking about Lieutenant General retired Jim Kowalski, who was one of the earliest leaders of Global Strike Command, Air Force Global Strike Command. And the reason we're talking about Global Strike Command is because they're celebrating their 15th anniversary. And I thought, who better to have on NucleCast to talk about why we needed to and did stand up Global Strike Command than the former commander himself. And so, General Kowalski, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I appreciate the invitation and appreciate what you and your team are doing out there.
So you were, you know, around and a part of the creation of this command. You sort of were, you know, watching and participating in all those events that took place preceding its creation and then subsequent to it. Can you lay out for the listeners why the Air Force created a new MAGCOM that, you know, to consolidate the Air Force's nuclear enterprise?
Right. Well, a lot of folks might remember there was an incident back at the end of August of 2007 where the Air Force had shipped warheads from Minot Air Force Base to Barksdale Air Force Base. And it was part of a larger operation, and the warheads were supposed to have been replaced up at Minot Air Force Base with dummies. This was all part of how the Air Force was retiring the advanced cruise missile. I think it's the AGM-129. And so they were shipping them down to Barksdale to be demilitarized. And this had gone on a number of times. And it's actually a fairly complex process to do that because, we've sort of designed these missiles to be on the wings when you take off, but not necessarily be on the wings when you land. So there are weight and balance issues, there's range issues, there's emergency issues. You want to have great weather, you're going to be pretty heavy when you land, et cetera, et cetera. So, the crews tended to be focused more on completing that mission safely and successfully, and we're just did not execute checklists right. There were problems with the munitions and how they were tracking and preparing different pylons to be loaded on the airplane, et cetera. As it happens, I was the deputy director for what they called global operations on the joint staff, which basically means that my portfolio of divisions as a one star working for the J3, who is a three star, mimicked pretty closely everything that Strategic Command had at the time. Now, if you we're in sort of a different deterrence world right now, I've heard it called the third age of nuclear deterrence. I've heard some people call it deterrence 3.0. If you think back to 2007, that was, I guess, deterrence 2.0, the second age of deterrence, because we had come out of the Cold War. We were in this post-Cold War period. The military was entirely focused on terrorism, the global war on terrorism. And as far as nuclear goes, the general push was, let's see how low we can get these levels. Let's have strategic stability. And if we're worried about anything nuclear, it's about terrorists get their hands on a weapon. So Strategic Air Command had gone away. A lot of command and control and accountability and responsibility had been dispersed across some other commands. And so I'm on the joint staff at the time, and because I had the nuclear operations division, when the call came in to the National Military Command Center, I'm the guy they called at 2 a.m. to say, and I remember the conversation very, very vividly, and the conversation basically went, hey, along the lines of a B-52 has landed at Barksdale Air Force Base. It has weapons on board. It wasn't supposed to have weapons on board. Is this a big deal? Is there something we should do about it? Not to throw anybody under the bus, but, it was probably an Army general who really didn't understand what had just happened, but he knew enough that when you declare what they call a bent spear, which is a nuclear weapon related incident, there's a list of people to call. Next question he had was, do I need to call anybody? I said, after I get over my initial shock of, no, that couldn't possibly happen, my response was, yeah, you got to call everybody. so don't hesitate on that list. We need to get moving on it. So it was, really just an emotional event for some extent for someone like me who had been in the nuclear enterprise so very long, and to have something like this happen was frankly not believable. It was unthinkable. And what came out of that incident, if people want to find out more about it, there's a number of reports and I'll talk about what they were, but clearly, a significant breach of our surety processes and procedures, and of operational oversight. So, obviously, there were all kinds of studies going on. People were now analyzing. We're building storyboards, and it ends up being you've got the core was a couple of task forces. First was the one that was done via the Defense Science Board, which was General Welch's initial task force on nuclear weapons surety, and it focused primarily on that incident to try to get to the bottom of that. And the Air Force at the same time were doing their own deep study and dive and to come up with corrective actions. And as the months, 2007 moved into 2008. In March of 2008, it was announced that that Defense Logistics Agency had accidentally shipped nuclear ICBM fuses. They're about 2 feet tall, cone shaped. They had shipped those to Taiwan 2 years ago, in 2006, and Nobody knew that had happened. That caused another big panic of, oh my gosh, this isn't just the Air Force. This is much wider. So Task Force Phase 2 was implemented under James Schlesinger to put attention on the rest of the department and how the rest of the department is doing those studies. So both of those studies are easily accessible on the internet. In October, the Air Force announces the new command that they were going to stand up Global Strike Command. A lot of that came out of those reports. It also came with the replacement of the chief and the secretary in June of 2008, partially for the nuclear incident, but also for a number of other things. And this sort of gave them a clean slate. And I think General Schwartz had already had his retirement papers in as from the TRANSCOM commander, and they asked him to take over the chief's responsibility, and then Donnelly became the Secretary of the Air Force. As you go through 2008 and head into 2009, there's now a number of, because we've implemented nuclear surety inspections, no notice. We've increased the focus both in the Air Force and at the joint level and at DITRA, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, on nuclear surety procedures. So what happens over that next year and a half is a number of nuclear surety inspection failures, and culminating sort of with Kirtland Air Force Base, which of course is an important link in the nuclear architecture of how we handle, maintain, and work weapons. They ended up being decertified in January of 2009, based on a failure that they had in November. So, clearly a lot of work to be done here. So in parallel with that, we're trying to get ready to stand up Air Force Global Strike Command. I was selected to be the provisional commander. So before you can stand up a major command, you have what they call a provisional command. It is a command with one person assigned to it, and that's the commander. And everybody else in the command is there as a temporary duty. I think the Air Force, the Air Force had done what they call a PAD. So it's a programming action directive. And the role of the provisional command was to bring these people together to execute the items in the programming action directive, to coordinate with the major commands, in this case, Air Force Space Command and Air Combat Command, on responsibilities and billet movements, and to basically flesh out the unit manning document so that we can be resourced not only with dollars, but be resourced with personnel. It was a coincidence that the Air Force had been in the process of standing up a cyber command. And that cyber command was at Barksdale Air Force Base. So they already had laid in billets and that had already been through the planning and programming process. And because the billets were already there, that became sort of an easy fix to say, okay, well, we'll use these billets to start, and then we'll go back into next year's, because the incident happened at the end of a fiscal year, and we got stood up. We're already planning 3 years out, so we're lagging the planning and budgeting process. But you knew that. I mean, that's the way the Defense Department works. But there are workarounds in there. We just had to navigate our way to get the resourcing that was needed when we first got going and got in there. As we stood up the command, there was I reached out to a lot of mentors. I had mentors reaching out to me. I had people that became mentors that reached out to me. We had some formal guidance, and we had some informal guidance. And one of the important parts of the informal guidance was that the Air Force wanted this to be a model command, that it was going to be a lean command. They recognized that there were a lot of billets and a lot of headquarters that were there because they always had a lot of billets and a lot of headquarters. So they intentionally stood this up as a lean command, which meant we outsourced some responsibilities, particularly leaving some base management activities in Air Combat Command on the planning and programming. As we stood up our what we call our 5-8 shop to do planning and programming, they had to do a lot of coordination with Air Force Space Command and Air Combat Command through 2013, because we didn't really have any budgeting authorities. They were, because all of those budgets and programs were, you know, nested inside these other two commands. So we just had to work all of that going forward until I think it may have been FY14 that became, you know, the first full-on Global Strike Command, POM.
Can I ask a sort of an intervening question?
Sure.
So when you hear the story of the stand-up of Global Strike and sort of what, you know, led to its creation, you know, the two incidences that you described are always, you know, the sort of offered as this is why we did it.
Yeah.
But if you go back, you know, well before that, go back to when, you know, General McPeak, you know, stood down Strategic Air Command, and then sort of the dissimulation of, you know, the eventually the ICBMs go to Space Command, and, you know, the bombers go to Air Combat Command, and there's this total lack of focus on nuclear issues because, of course, we don't need them anymore. They're Cold War relics, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Missileer's mantra was if you're not in space, you're not in the race. And so you had this, you know, focus on space, not ICBMs. Was there any point prior to the two incidents that there was sort of already a discussion about, hey, you know, we've taken our eye off the ball, you know, the bombers and ICBMs are not where they belong. We really kind of need, you know, SAC back, or was it really just sort of, there was that no discussion like that. And then it was just really a aha moment.
Yeah.
How was that?
Well, it depends on where, you know, what you see depends on where you sit. You know, so, if you're an operational crew member and you're flying B-1s and you've been through nuclear surety inspections and you've been through nuclear ORIs, you know, the prospect of not having nuclear surety inspections and nuclear ORIs anymore because you're going to be conventional only is actually pretty invigorating. You know? And then you find yourself post 9/11 and you're going, yeah, I want to be in that fight. And that's who we want in our Air Force, in our military, is folks that run to the sound of guns. And that's always been the challenge with the nuclear enterprise, is when absolutely nothing is happening, you're doing your job, you know, which is very hard for military people, to get their mind around, to understand that, yeah, our job is to be perfect at a task we hope never to do. Because if we do this well enough, if we fund it right, if we get the right resourcing in the equipment and the tools of warfare at this level, then we intimidate our adversaries, and that is deterrence. But you get a young gung-ho guy, and, you know, he doesn't really want to go down in a silo and stand that alert, particularly when, you know, and then you can go back to, you know, 2008. You can go back even further than that, you know, when, you know, I've got, you know, 4-star general quotes in the Air Force going, yeah, you know, I hope we get rid of all these nuclear weapons. Well, yeah. You know, I get it, you know, in my heart, you know, I hope we do too. But the reality of the world is not there. And, you know, so when you go back and you read the 2008 things and, you know, what was the kind of verbiage that was out there about the nuclear business, and it was all make it smaller, make it smaller, make it smaller. You know, we want that. We want a bumper sticker on our car that says 1,000 warheads. Yeah. We want a bumper sticker on our car that says 500. There seemed to be that constant push downward. And that's fine. I mean, we're in a democracy. But on the other hand, without a unified command to continually remind the people that are in the business of, hey, this is important. You know, I understand we're post-Cold War. This is really important. And it's important because the world can change. It's important because there remain adversaries out there, even if at the time we didn't think those were Russia and China. And as we get later into those years, you get toward 2014, you know, you can say, well, you know, Russia's changed their position now with the invasion of Ukraine. And nothing really else really changed, I think, until we started getting smart about where China was going with their nuclear forces. So it's probably a really long answer to what should have been a simple question. But so, yes, there were people that recognized that we got to still keep these folks motivated. And I'd probably call out General Welch in particular. And I tried to find the reports that he had done in the 90s on this, and I was unable to find them online. Maybe you can find them, Adam. But I remember he had done at least one report that resulted in Air Combat Command ramping up their inspections and stuff for a little while just before the nuclear mission left the B-1s. So there were calls out there telling the Defense Department and Congress that be careful here. You know, we're losing some of that, but.
So it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'd be curious to know, you know, the Navy and the Navy's boomer fleet, they never really had sort of this challenge. They were never dissimilated. They were never broken up. So whenever y'all were standing up the new Global Strike Command, did you look to the Navy? Did you talk to the Navy? And do you think, were you pursuing a culture similar to theirs? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to General Jim Kowalski about the early days of Air Force Global Strike Command, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary. And before the break, I posited, you know, did we talk to our Navy brethren and, you know, see how they had managed to handle sort of the lean years of the 90s and early 2000s?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, of course. You know, there hadn't been, and I think you saw it might have been under General Wilson or General Rand that we started doing these exchanges with the Navy too. But you know, at the time, absolutely, we were talking to the Navy. Their structure is different. You know, they and then how they groom their people is different, and that has been a topic of conversation among the the nuclear folks in the Air Force for a long time, is how can we get there? Well, they're different enough that we haven't found a way to do that. Although I think that is one positive thing that I see coming out of this proposed reorganization is that the nuclear warfare center commander or the nuclear weapons center commander is going to be elevated to a 3-star. That is something that had been proposed, you know, more than a decade ago and was not accepted. And for a while there, even it wasn't considered one of the core centers of AFMC, which was problematic in itself. But where we are right now is waiting to see how that turns out. But operationally, they did not go through the disruption that the Air Force went through. But the Air Force, you know, sort of almost had to go through some level of disruption if you're going to remove the force that provided the nuclear elements to Strategic Command, and the Navy, they didn't really change those elements.
You know, yeah,
they still provided the same one thing, and they did it through the same chain of command. And it largely, you know, the dissolution of SAC, you know, did not ripple through them the way it did the Air Force.
Was there any desire or discussion in those early days? As you point out, the Navy, they never said, we'll take the Ohio class and we'll make it focus on conventional, you know, Tomahawks or anything. They stayed exactly as they were. Their mission never changed.
Yeah.
But for the Air Force, it was a total disruption. Was there ever a discussion, and perhaps during this early stand-up period, where people said, you know, we've allowed the B-1s, they're a conventional bomber now. The B-52s do both conventional and nuclear, mostly conventional. You know, the B-2s are focused primarily on a nuclear mission, but they still do conventional operations. Should we have a dedicated nuclear bomber force that doesn't do conventional operations? Was there any discussion in those sort of early years where this topic was debated and, you know, some rationale was achieved for not going in that direction?
Well, when they first, for example, if you look back to the late 80s, the early 90s, there were some conventional-only squadrons in the B-52 community. Mm-hmm. And there was some thought that, why don't we just do conventional only and nuclear? Of course, everybody then wants to be in the conventional only squadron, not necessarily the nuclear squadrons. So, you know, that was recognized early on, too, is that from the bomber perspective, we really are better off keeping that mission set together. And for a number of reasons. I think the first reason is you need to have a pool of the best people to fill your leadership positions. And if you aren't able to cross those two streams and move from one to the other, you're not going to get that best pool. You're just going to grow people in one smaller field. The other thing is understanding nuclear and the value of nuclear deterrence and how it fits in with larger plans, both from an Air Force campaign level to a combatant campaign level, you really need to appreciate both parts of that. And frankly, that's one problem that the Air Force still has not been able to resolve within itself, is how do we educate our young airmen and officers on the nuclear mission set? And I don't know where it is now. I left the movie 10 years ago, but when I left, I was still frustrated that it seemed to be a check the square kind of thing. Yeah, we'll send you this course. You'll go to, you know, Air Command and Staff, and you'll have this one class. You know, it's bigger than a class. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it should require much longer engagement and involvement and discussion than where we've ended up. So that's another reason. And frankly, that's one concern that I had when it became all this stuff is leaving Air Combat Command. Air Combat Command, I was a deputy to the director of operations out there, and Air Combat Command does a whole lot of things, a broad range of things at Air Campaigning. I mean, they're home for all of this. If they don't have people on their staff that understand nuclear and can engage in thoughtful conversations in the planning elements, then the Air Force loses. And you know what you know, and you don't always know what you don't know. And so those folks that have grown up and gone through fighter weapons school and all the rest of that, and they're at a headquarters where they don't even have conversation with long-range strike people, you know, that should be worrisome a little bit. And I've seen the results of that and some early planning of other operations that I won't get into here. But you don't want to be coming in on a plan at the last second and go, hey, did you think about this? And then, crap, no, we didn't think about that. Oh, you carry how many bombs? That's another reason that having separate squadrons, I don't think is really helpful. That you need that, you need the synergy of those together. And long term, we need airmen that, there's an apocryphal story that was told to me by I won't throw his name out there, but he taught at Georgetown. I'm sure you know him, about being out in another theater and talking to them about nuclear issues. And this is back in, Deterrence 2.0, and how they're going to execute a campaign. And then what happens if your adversary uses a nuclear weapon? And the planner's response was, well, then it's over to STRATCOM. Well, wait a minute. You can't just toss it over the transom. And yeah, and give it to STRATCOM. So I think you saw this about I've lost the name here. The chairman started pushing. I know Dunford did this too. Started pushing to, hey, we got to integrate this. We can't be having conventional only exercises against nuclear armed adversaries. We need to think about what happens if nuclear weapons get involved here. And it was really hard to do, but that was one of the things I know we were working on when I was the deputy at STRATCOM, was getting engaged in these exercises and bringing our planners together to create some familiarity across that seam between conventional and nuclear, because war is war, and we can talk about nuclear weapons and their deterrent value, but if you honestly want them to be credible, then you need to be doing the planning on using them and integrating that planning with your combatant commanders. That's the kind of thing that will deter an adversary. We always talk about deterrence. It's will and capability. Well, you're demonstrating a capability, and the fact that you're doing that and resourcing that also demonstrates your will.
Now, we're unfortunately out of time, but here's what I want to do. Would you be able to stay for another 30 minutes and we'll record a second? Because I stopped you in 2014 and you never really got to move on with that story, but I want to sort of get through there. Would you be able to stay for another half hour and finish this out? Okay, well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but what we're going to do is, this has been a great conversation and one that I think needs to continue. So we're going to record a second episode, a part two, because this is, we've done a lot on NucleCast to try to capture the history of the nuclear enterprise. We've had historians, we've had folks from the labs to talk about the early days of the Manhattan Project. And this is also one of those sort of critical times in the nuclear enterprise's history that we want to keep for posterity. And of course, we're talking to, the provisional commander, one of the guys who stood it up and was there when, the incidents happened. And so we want to continue this discussion. And so what we're going to do is we're going to save Bob the Genie for the second episode, because I'm sure you are all as interested as I am about what General Kowalski's wishes for the future are. So we'll save that, and we'll end this initial episode. And of course, I want to say thanks to you, General Kowalski. Thanks for coming on. And thanks to you, the listeners. And hopefully you've enjoyed this first episode, but of course you'll have to listen to the second episode to get the whole story. So we'll see you next time on NucleCast. So it's interesting. It's great to talk to General Kowalski, because those events that led to the stand up of Global Strike Command is how I got into the nuclear world myself, because I was a counterterrorism guy early on. I had worked in, the Middle East, and then those incidents happen, and I get handed by the Air Force the work to examine those incidents, and that's how it brought me in. So even though I was there, talking to General Kowalski gave me another perspective where I learned some things that I didn't know from my own experience. So that was really interesting. Hopefully you'll stay around for the second episode.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at Nuclicast.